This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. Hello.
Hello. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. I'm going to start today with our questions for the audience because we'd really love to hear from you this hour. Here are the questions. Where do you draw the line between criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism? And what do you think of President Trump's approach to combating anti-Semitism? Of course, these questions are in the news because there have been several actions taken by the federal government to, in their view, crack down on anti-Semitism on college campuses. This includes revoking visas, detaining pro-Palestinian activists, and freezing billions of dollars in federal funding. This impacts local universities and some very high-profile national universities like Harvard. Also this hour, we'd like to hear from students about the impact of the administration's actions on college campuses. So give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the chat.
Yeah, and I'm excited about today's conversation. We have two guests who have very differing views, but I really hope people call in and offer their perspective. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
All right, trio of local news stories,
yes.
Shall we?
Yes.
Start us off, Cherry.
Well, a massive wildfire in Ocean County prompted the evacuation of 5,000 residents on Tuesday. But as of 10 a.m. this morning, the evacuation order has been 100% lifted. It's the Jones wildfire, and it grew from 150 acres to about 11,500 acres. And as of this morning, it's 30% contained. At one point Tuesday night, more than 1,300 structures were under threat. The sheer size of that fire led New Jersey acting governor Tahisha Way to declare a state of emergency. That went into effect this morning. And thanks to the work of fire and rescue crews, they have made significant progress. And according to the New Jersey Forest Fire Service X account, only 20 structures continue to remain under threat. But a building was completely destroyed. Multiple vehicles were destroyed. Luckily, no one was injured, but authorities right now are assessing the damage.
Yeah, scary situation in New Jersey, and these scary situations pop up more frequently.
Yeah.
We've seen an increase in wildfire activity in the state of New Jersey. You know, wildfire is a part of the natural state of play in the Pine Barrens and parts of New Jersey, but at the same time, you have to balance that with the health and welfare of the people who live there. And we do hope, of course, that that contained number continues
yes,
to go up.
For sure.
Story number two now, and this is a story you're all familiar with. Just a couple weeks ago, Governor Josh Shapiro and his family were very nearly injured in an arson attack on the governor's mansion. And we're still sorting through the facts of that case, the details. The man responsible, or who has claimed responsibility apparently, is in custody. But a very interesting piece that the governor himself authored in the New York Times. It's an op-ed, his description of what happened that night and his reflections on it. I won't recap all of it. I would encourage you to read it in the governor's words, right? And there are some really affecting passages in there. But you should check out that op-ed in the New York Times from Governor Josh Shapiro talking about that night. And again, his reflections since then. Cherry, you had a chance to read this, I assume.
Yes. And it definitely touches your heart. I mean, his family was there. They had just celebrated, a religious meal and everything like that. And I'll also say that, you know, Governor Shapiro reopened the governor's mansion to the public on Tuesday for an Easter egg hunt. And he said, I'm not going to live in fear. And what's so interesting, if you look at the photos of the mansion, it shows these huge trash bins as they were collecting debris and disposing of fire damaged material from that arson attack.
Yeah.
But then on another part of the lawn, kids are rolling Easter eggs,
yeah,
you know, looking for Easter eggs. So he's trying his best, I guess, to reconcile with that. And part of that is sort of addressing it head on and writing about it.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about what he said. And then there's a lot to be said about what
he didn't say.
Yeah. You know, he's a public figure. And as a result, what he says about this incident carries a lot of weight. And he wrote in this op-ed, quote, "It is not my job to opine on what the motive was or what the charges should be. He's simply not wading into that. And he has sort of repeated the mantra of tolerance and reaching out across the divide and bringing people together. And he could have responded to this incident in a very different way. And so his approach is notable in what it reflects about him as a person, but he's also a public figure. It's notable for what it reflects about his politics and how he chooses to speak about this incident. And it is fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, there was that Easter egg hunt. It was a pretty nice day on Tuesday. And
the weather, you're
the
saying.
The weather.
Yes, the weather was lovely.
The weather was lovely, and it's been getting lovelier. Yes. We're fully in spring.
That tends to happen in spring.
I love
it. Cherry.
Yeah, and so time for a picnic.
Is it time for a picnic?
It's getting close. Philly Mag rounded up 15 scenic picnic spots in Philly. A couple of them are on my favorites list. And I have to say, it's officially picnic season in Philadelphia.
Wait. Officially?
Officially, yeah. On the city website. The city. The city, this is the time between that it starts in April where you can actually apply for a permit to have a picnic in the city's many parks. And there's like a specific.
I thought like someone went to City Hall with a declaration.
But it's the season from begins in April and it goes through, I guess, like October where you can get permits and have picnics. Okay.
Right.
So that's picnic season. So I love a good picnic because honestly, Avi, I really do enjoy napping in the grass on a blanket. And I live in the city. I don't have any grass. So I got to go to the park to do that. And so this got us thinking here, what's a great picnic spot? And if you have a picnic basket, what's in it? And what's going to be playing on the mini Bluetooth speaker?
Okay, so we're kind of constructing a perfect
picnic. We're going to construct that.
Now that it's officially picnic season, apparently.
According to the city.
Okay, so which one should we start with? Which category?
Let's start with picnic spot. Because you're the park guy. So.
I am. I wasn't super ambitious with this particular pick. I picked a place I thought was pretty obvious, but I don't think it was actually in the list of 15 from Philly Mag. I'm going with Lemon Hill in Fairmount
Park.
That's
actually a good spot. Yeah, that's a really good spot.
Yeah, so that's a nice spot. It sort of overlooks the art museum and the river. You do hear the highway, which some people I think that's, you know, whatever. That's not great. But I kind of like the integration of city noise into your city retreat.
Yeah, I've been there several times. I like that park a lot. And it's a cool place to go walking if you're down there by Schuylkill River Trail.
What's your spot?
Mine is Penn Treaty Park. As folks know, I just moved to the East Kensington, you know, Fishtown area. This was actually on the Philly Mag list.
Oh.
They have a great view of the Delaware River. You can see the Ben Franklin Bridge. And it stays pretty clean. You know, you got to look around because people got their dogs. But it's a cool little
everywhere.
Spot. You know what
that's
I mean?
That's everywhere. We'll deal with the dog people in a different episode.
At a totally different episode. So.
Okay, I like that. I like Penn Treaty Park quite a bit. Okay, so number two, we're doing a food that has to be part of our picnic spread. My food is potato salad.
Okay. All right, you got
egg
or no egg.
They showed a picture of potato salad on the screen, and that's a terrible picture. Ugh. No, not too much mayo. Can I just say that? Not too much mayo.
Okay, I got respect for you.
Yeah.
That's good. You can come to the cookout.
Maybe like a
that's
German
good.
Potato salad.
Yeah, I like that. Mine is kind of cheating. I like charcuterie boards.
Okay.
Style.
I'm with you on charcuterie boards.
Mm-hmm.
Here is my issue. Like, I like all of those foods at a picnic. Putting them on a board, I feel like, or arranging them outside like that, I feel like is asking for trouble. There's going to be spills. It's going to be messy.
Well,
it just feels not contained enough.
A big plastic container or a bigger glass container and wrap it with Saran wrap.
Okay.
Kind of pre-place it before you get there. Drop it, wrap it real tight and put it in there. And then it's already made. And by the way, the hubby likes protein, so we're going to put wings on ours.
Shout out to the hubby.
Wings on the charcuterie.
Finally, our music choices.
Yes.
So this is the music that puts us in the mood for a picnic. I went with Willie Nelson.
I'm not surprised because you love country music.
I like country music, but I love Willie Nelson.
Okay.
And I just feel like he's got the right energy for a picnic.
Yeah. Mine is pianist Robert Glasper.
Who?
He is a pianist. He does soul, jazz. He has, wow, I mean, sometimes there's instrumental, sometimes he'll team up with somebody like Ledisi or Her and do a little bit of a soul mix, but it's just a good background sound coming from the Bluetooth speaker.
I feel like you beat me on this one. I like your Picnic a little better than mine. I will say I find Picnics to be aspirational. Uh-huh. Like everyone thinks they're going to have a million Picnics, but at the end of the day, like
there's just one or two.
You go to like, you do like one a year because they're just too much hassle. In your mind, every April, you're like, I'm going to do like seven
every weekend,
picnics.
I'm going to be having a picnic.
And it just never turns out that way.
Lies.
Lies, okay. lies. Okay, so stick with us on Studio 2. A very serious conversation coming up about anti-Semitism and the Trump administration's approach to combating anti-Semitism. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You have probably heard about the standoff between the Trump administration and Harvard University. It's over billions of dollars in federal funding, all of it frozen because the school allegedly failed to protect Jewish students. Harvard is now suing the government, saying in part that this move violates the First Amendment.
The White House has threatened funding at dozens of universities, including University of Pennsylvania and Princeton. It has revoked hundreds of student visas and has detained pro-Palestinian campus protesters in its efforts to root out anti-Semitism. But many people on the left, including many Jewish Americans, are saying this is overreach and that anti-Semitism is being weaponized for political purposes. Others have cheered the president's approach, especially at a time when we are seeing a rise in anti-Semitic incidents. A brand new Anti-Defamation League report came out yesterday showing another spike in anti-Semitic incidents and a big rise on college campuses.
So today on Studio 2, how should we fight anti-Semitism and what impact is it having on schools and campus speech? We are joined by two guests who bring different perspectives to this issue. Jay Green is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Jay, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
And Kenneth Stern is director of the Bard Center for the Study of Hate and the author of The Conflict Over the Conflict, the Israel-Palestine Campus Debate. Kenneth Stern, welcome.
Thank you for having me as well.
And for our listeners at home and online, the question of the day are these. What do you think of President Trump's approach to anti-Semitism? Where do you draw the line between criticisms of Israel and anti-Semitism? And we'd also really like to hear from students this hour about the impact of the administration's actions on college campuses. You can call 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop your comments in the chat. And we wanted to sort of start this conversation, Jay and Kenneth, by getting a foundation so that we all are on the same page and have a good understanding of what you think anti-Semitism is. So could you each take a moment and just define it for us from your point of view and then try to explain why has it been so hard to define generally? And Jay, we'll start with you and then we'll go to Kenneth.
So I want to say that I actually don't think the definition of anti-Semitism is really very central to the question of whether we have an anti-Semitism problem on campus and whether the Trump administration is correct in seeing potential Title VI violations and taking steps against them. So, I mean, we can talk about it, but I don't think it's actually relevant because there are so many abuses. Mm-hmm. Harassment of Jews, physically, threats of violence, that under any reasonable definition of anti-Semitism would constitute impediments to Jewish students accessing education in these universities, that it doesn't really matter. So we don't have to adjudicate whether anti-Israel sentiment is inherently anti-Semitic or not. We can talk about that, but that's actually not germane to whether these universities have failed to fulfill their Title VI obligations.
All right. And Jay, if you could define it for us.
Ken.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. And I agree with Jay that, you know, what we should be focusing on is not definitions per se, but whether the students are actually getting harassed and victims of true threats, assaults, bullied, discrimination, and so forth. And that's on one side of the line. and the other is about questions about speech that people may not like. And there's a robust debate about whether anti-Zionism is always anti-Semitism or not. And I think there are certain cases where it's clearly anti-Semitic. There are some cases where it's clearly not anti-Semitic. There's a whole bunch of areas where it's in the gray area. You're looking at intent, you're looking what people hear and so forth. But that shouldn't be the debate. And that's one of the things that worries me at the moment, because we're talking about going after pure speech as opposed to are people in the context of using the speech actually harassing others.
So let's go to that, Ken. I feel like a lot of this comes down to what you actually think is happening on campuses or has been happening over the last couple of years. I mean, in your estimation, how do you describe what is happening on college campuses?
Well, you want me to go first?
Yeah, Ken.
I wrote a book. I wrote a book. The book you mentioned, it was 5 years ago, and I saw a problem on the campus was that each side on the Israel-Palestine debate going into their silos and believing they were all right, the other side was all wrong. And the way to approach it was to silence the speech on the other side. And they used different means. So some of the pro-Palestinian folks would heckle speakers and stop programs from happening. We've seen too much of that. But on the other side, I've seen people trying to use law and the definition of anti-Semitism, for which I was a lead drafter, to try to go after what professors are teaching or what speakers are coming to campus. So the problem is that each side feels so self-righteous that it's trying to shut down the other side. And part of how I look at this is I run a hate studies center. And we know when people get their identity tethered to an issue of perceived social justice or injustice, certain things happen. There's even brain science behind this. They crave certainty. They crave simplicity. They crave binary thinking. And they feel justified in shutting down the other side, as opposed to on a college, what you want to do is say, wait a minute, there are people that have strong, diverse opinions about an issue like this. Let's look at this. Why does somebody else have a different point of view? How are we going to teach about it, as opposed to how we're going to beat up somebody for having the wrong point of view on something like this?
Jay, I want your perspective on this, though. Like, there is this question of, okay, so there's protests happening. There's encampments at some universities. Is that speech or is that something beyond speech that becomes an impediment to learning? Because then you get into Title VI and whether or not there are violations of Title VI. I think before you even get into whether there are violations of Title VI, you have to sort of make the case that this is beyond speech, right, Jay? Or do you think speech alone is a violation?
So if the speech is harassing speech or creates a hostile environment that impedes a student's ability to access education, then that speech can be restricted. I mean, there are time, place, and manner restrictions that universities have developed on speech and must develop and enforce uniformly in order not to run afoul of their Title VI obligations. And again, I think a lot of the examples that we could cite are unambiguous. So just yesterday, there was a protest at Yale where Jewish students were blocked from crossing campus. They were blocked simply because they could be identified as Jews because they were wearing kippot. This has happened at Harvard, Columbia, Berkeley, UCLA. This is all on film. This has happened repeatedly. Universities have failed to enforce their rules, which prohibit this activity. They have failed to discipline students, to suspend or expel students for violations. And so universities failing to enforce their own rules to protect students from blocking them from accessing their educational opportunity is clearly a Title VI violation. And this has happened repeatedly at many elite campuses across the country. And that's why I think the Trump administration has drawn its attention to this issue and has given notice to universities that they really need to develop and enforce consistent rules about behavior in order to protect Jewish students from this repeated harassment.
I mean, real quick, Ken, do you agree with that assessment that there's been repeated blocking, sort of physical obstruction?
I agree and disagree. I think clearly blocking somebody's rite of passage, I think disrupting the class, like happened at Barnard, and there were sanctions, that's appropriate. You can't disrupt a class from going on. On the other hand, I disagree that there are certain, words that are inherently harassing. I mean, there's the whole debate over from the river to the sea. I find that disturbing. I understand what Hamas means by that. But there was a survey that 66% of Jewish students believe that that believes, eradicating Israel. Only 14% of Muslim students perceive it that way. And then there's a debate about, wait a minute, from a Palestinian perspective, would say Israel has sovereignty from the river to the sea. And if you look at the Likud party platform, it talked about sovereignty from the river to the sea. And there was a cute clip that said that, students didn't even know which river in the sea they were talking about. So the question, I don't think that there's inherently words that are harassing. I think harassment is harassing when it's engaged directly. And what I worry about the moment is that it's not just saying we're going to go after speech. You're talking about reshuffling departments. You're talking about going after, DEI things. And then DEI is a varied thing too. I think there's some places where DEI is problematic, some places where it's not, but it's going after the whole university. And one thing that I learned when I was working at the American Jewish Committee for 25 years and had the portfolio for the campus is that when you look at particular different institutions and you're worried about anti-Semitism, you can't have one size fits all. You have to look at what makes the university, in this case, what does it tick? What are its values? How do you go and tell it, here's what we should be doing in a way that resonates with its values? And those are the things that promote academic freedom. Finally, one of the things that really worries me is that there was a whole process that's laid out by law for what the Office of Civil Rights should be doing. I worked with the OCR on anti-Semitism cases. They were focused on educational outcomes. And there was a process that got the university to buy in or the high school to buy in. Now what we're doing is saying we're beating you up, we're threatening you, that's going to backfire. And that's why you've seen a lot of Jewish organizations, and in fact, some, others that are even conservative folks saying this is a problem going after the whole university in this way.
And Ken, I wanted to ask you because, are Jewish students the only students on campus that are feeling this? Because I wonder if it's really about protecting students, because I understand some Palestinian students also feel threatened. Can you talk about that perspective? And because it's not, it's just tense on campus because people from all sides are dealing with this. Can you
That's right. I
expound on
mean,
that?
one of the things that we've had hearings on anti-Semitism, very little on the anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian animus. We've had doxing trucks. We've had people have threats. We had an attack on an encampment at UCLA. It goes on all levels. And then there's another complexity here too, is that Jewish students are not monolithic on this. There are many Jewish students who are very involved in pro-Palestinian demonstrations. There are many Jewish students, again, they're a minority, but it's a growing number, whose Judaism leads them to an anti-Zionist position. And so that, they're also getting stigmatized in this too. So it's across the board. And the question is, how does a university make it so that students realize that they are physically going to be safe? They are not going to be discriminated against, but they are going to hear things that disturb them to their core. And then we're going to, teach about it. At Bard, I had a colleague that saw students flinging around terms like settler colonialism and anti-Semitism and Zionism and so forth. And she said, why don't we have a class? What a novel idea. And what do these words mean? And why do people hear them differently? That should be the approach.
Let me read in some comments now. Amora says, you can despise what a government is doing and not hate the people. I don't agree with what Netanyahu is doing, but I don't blame all Jews for his actions. That's more on YouTube. Lauren on YouTube says, are Jewish students being disappeared from campus? I think it's fairly clear that the people being harassed are the anti-genocide crowd. So let me put that to you, Jay Green, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. What about folks saying, look, I mean, Muslim students are being targeted, people who have spoken out in favor of Palestinian statehood, gone to a protest, written an op-ed, that, their universities are not doing enough to protect them, and that might be a violation of their civil rights. So what do you make of that argument, Jay Green?
So, First, let me just make clear that government, what we're talking about here is government funding of universities, taxpayer funding of universities. And taxpayer funding is not an entitlement. It's a privilege, and it comes with conditions. And the conditions are that universities have to abide by the Civil Rights Act, and particularly by Title VI. Title VI provides protection based on race or national origin. Does not actually provide protection on the basis of religion. Jews are covered because they are seen as having a national origin. To the extent that groups of students feel like they're being persecuted because they express a certain political position, that is not actually covered under Title VI. So if you have a position that you think that a country is guilty of genocide, and you think that you're being treated badly because you hold that position, that's not part of a university's civil rights obligation. It may be good, sensible practice for a university to take ideas seriously and engage them and have conversations about them and teach about them, just as Ken suggested, and I agree with that. But what we're talking about here is not a speech issue. There are no free speech exemptions to enforcement of the civil rights law. The conditions of Title VI can't be waived because universities say we wish to have autonomy or we wish to have free speech. They have those obligations even if it infringes on their speech to some extent, and they can opt out of receiving federal money and be free to say and do whatever they want that's otherwise within the law. Some universities do this. Hillsdale, for example.
Just to be clear, the point you're making is that you're arguing that because the civil rights law does not obligate the universities to protect this particular class, that it's sort of irrelevant in this conversation.
No, I said that it's good practice.
But irrelevant in terms of the money conversation. That the money can only be withheld because of anti-Semitic practices or sort of violations on that vector, as opposed to violations.
Well, can be on the basis of race. So let's just do a little thought experiment just for a second, because I think it might help clarify things. Let's pretend that there's an orchestrated group of students who really hate the Pan-African movement. Mm-hmm. They just hate it, okay? And they want to kill Africans. They say they have nothing against Black people, but they really hate Africans. And they choose to block Black students from crossing campus as they chant death to Africans. But they don't have any concerns with Black people, okay? So they block students. They choose to go to the Black Student Association and stand in front of their organization and chant, you know, globalize the violent struggle against Africans.
Sure. I think I understand.
So let's imagine that. Let's imagine how we would feel about that. I think we would recognize this as targeted harassment of Black students on campus. That would clearly be a violation of Title VI. If universities failed to enforce their own rules and discipline students who engaged in this conduct, we would see those universities as falling short of their obligations, and therefore they would become eventually ineligible for receiving federal funds. That's what we're talking about here.
Right. So
technically, would that also be, would Title VI also protect Palestinian American students as well, who may feel pressure on campus?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Because that's a national origin, right?
So I don't know technically under your argument that Palestinians are recognized as of a national origin. But let's say they are. Yes, I think if Palestinian students feel like they're being systematically mistreated and that universities are failing to protect them, I think they should bring those concerns forward. And I think that those violations would also be of concern to the federal government.
And Ken, you had a comment, and we're going to bring
a couple of things. I mean, and that's right. I mean, there was a case at GW that included both Jewish students and Palestinian students. I think there is an important interest in protecting free speech and academic freedom. And I don't disagree with Jay about when it comes down to actual harassment, blocking, you know, that we all agree on that should not happen, and it shouldn't matter whether it's under Title VI or not. No student should be treated that way. But there, you know, where I disagree is that there are mechanisms under the law that require due process, that require a hearing, that require trying to come to a resolution, as opposed to just saying, oh, we think that there's something here and we're going to go and then claw back your money. Look at what it's going to do to, you know, to cancer research, other things that are falling by the wayside. And I don't want to forget your other question that you asked about, you know, the picking up of pro-Palestinian students. Mm-hmm. I mean, that deeply troubles me. Look at the student
sure.
at Tufts. As
yeah.
far as we can tell, the only thing that we know is that Canary Mission, which puts out a, you know, sort of a dossier, a blacklist of people whose speech they don't like. And I don't like some of the speech they list there either, but that's neither here nor there. They put her on there because she co-authored an op-ed that talked about boycott, divestment, and sanctions, you know, against Israel. And she was whisked away, you know, just
by masked men.
And then look at the underlying justification by the administration that she and also Khalil at
Mahmoud Khalil, yeah.
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 Their positions, what they've said, what they've, you know, articulated is a serious violation or serious challenge to the foreign policy and national security of the United States. So think about that for the moment. You have a student writing an op-ed or somebody speaking on a campus, supposedly handing out a leaflet, and that's what we're worried about? That's a serious threat to our national security? Are we that weak? And then expand that. So what happens if we have a different administration? What happens if somebody says something that's different than our policy on Ukraine or if our policy
China.
On Israel?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to bring in a couple. We have a bunch of people on the line, so I want to bring in a couple callers. And the question of the day is this: what do you think of President Trump's approach to anti-Semitism? Where do you draw the line between criticisms of Israel and anti-Semitism? The number is 888-477-9499. I want to bring in Katie from Philadelphia, who's been on the line. Katie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you. My question or comment is, why are we turning to a man who has fostered a rise in neo-Nazism to aid in anything to do with anti-Semitism?
Yeah, let me put that to you, Jay Green, because
yeah.
a lot
Thank
of
you,
comments
Katie.
Are on that exact sort of thrust, right? So as Ken has laid out, he's very concerned about the tactics being used. Whether or not we decide there are violations that have occurred, he's worried about the tactics being used, the sort of the blunt force of withholding all of these funds. And also a lot of our commenters are worried about mm-hmm. sort of entrusting that type of, you know, strategy in the hands of a man mm-hmm. or an administration that they believe has fostered anti-Semitism from the far right. I mean, Jay, do you have concerns about that?
So I think that a lot of this is really just filtered through what people think about Trump. So if people don't like Trump for some other reason, then they somehow feel like it's illegitimate for him to do the right thing on this issue, which is to enforce the civil rights law and protect Jewish students against harassment.
But it's the type of enforcement, I think, right? So that's what Ken has brought up. The sort of the method of enforcement is more extreme than what we've seen with past administrations in terms of civil rights violations. You disagree with that?
Well, I think that the shortcomings of the universities have been quite severe. I mean, this has been going on now for a year and a half of targeted harassment without universities enforcing their rules, and I think putting their funds in jeopardy is getting their attention and beginning to get them to enforce their rules, and that's significant progress in protecting Jews. Now, as to non-US citizens who are taken for deportation, that's not universities doing that. That is the administration doing that. And so that's not a civil rights violation on the parts of on the part of universities. But it is a speech, a question of what speech is protected on the part of non-citizens. Now, this is a matter of legal dispute, whether non-citizens have the same speech rights that citizens have, especially students who are on foreign student visas. After all, your speech abroad can disqualify you from gaining that visa and entering the country. Mm. And then the question would be whether speech that would make you ineligible to enter the country would also make you ineligible to stay in the country yeah. on a student.
So we are coming up on a
yes.
break. We want to talk about a lot of things on the other side of this break, including sort of if there are these violations, what the university should have done or should do moving forward. Let me read in this email from Sherry, who says Trump doesn't care about Jews. He just wants a way to exert control over universities. And then we have this from Michael in Philadelphia, who says Israel should be subject to the same standards as any other country. So keep those comments and emails and calls coming. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. We'll be right back. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're talking about how the Trump administration is combating anti-Semitism, specifically on college campuses, and the impact that it's having. We have two great guests who have different points of view. We have Jay Green, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and Kenneth Stern, director of the Bard Center for the Study of Hate and author of The Conflict Over the Conflict, the Israel-Palestine Campus Debate.
Our questions for you this hour: what do you think of President Trump's approach to anti-Semitism? Where do you draw the line between criticisms of Israel and anti-Semitism? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org or leave a comment in the YouTube chat.
And before the break, Ken, you kind of mentioned this. You talked about the Canary Mission, and groups like that have published online dossiers of student activists warning future employers. Some say it's fair game. Others say it's a blacklist. Can you explain a little bit what the Canary Mission is, who funds it, and what these lists contain?
Sure. It's sort of a shadowy group. There's been some reporting on the funding, but basically it's decided that it's going to create dossiers of mostly students, but some faculty and others too. And basically, as you said, when they launched it, these folks should never get hired. And what's troubling is at the current time, that group and another group called Batar are saying, wait a minute, we're turning in people to the government. Here are people that you should deport. And as a Jewish person who knows Jewish history, I'm very worried when Jewish groups say to the government, here are people, we don't like what you say, let's deport you. Because if you look at the security of Jews throughout history, it's been at times where democratic institutions have been strong, where the values have been strong, where authoritarian impulses have been pushed back against. And I'm worried about us helping that type of process. So one other thing that Katie's question I thought was very important, and it goes back to the initial question you asked about defining anti-Semitism. However you want to define it, at its most significant, it's two things. It's conspiracy theory that Jews are harming humanity and giving an explanation for what goes wrong in the world. And if you think about the contemporary moment, what worries me much more than what an 18-year-old is saying on a college campus is the idea that we're having political leadership saying that there's anybody among us who's a danger that we should vilify, that we should dehumanize, whether it's immigrants or Muslims or transgender folks, because those are the building blocks for anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. Just think back to Charlottesville. Jews will not replace us in a protest about Confederate statues. Why was that? That's because people thought that they were losing to people that they thought that they were superior to, and that somebody must be putting their fingers on the scale. So the things that are going to drive actual anti-Semitism at the moment are a lot of the things that this administration are doing. And I think, just focusing on they're trying to stop speech that I might not like some of that speech too, is going to backfire and harm our democracy and harm Jews.
Yeah, and my follow-up question to you, Ken, on that issue is, what do these blacklists sort of do? Because I looked at the Canary Mission website, and I went through some of the schools in our local region. You have people on there who just attended a protest or attended one of the encampments. They aren't necessarily people who even spoke there. And so I just wonder, what is the impact on campuses and more broadly when these types of lists are created so loosely?
Yeah, there were some folks that have been on the Canary Mission list years ago that I find some of the things that they said is reprehensible. But again, it's speech as opposed to actual harassment for the most part. And what does it do? It has a chilling effect, on people's ability to discuss, issues that are pertinent to the question of Israel, Palestine, Gaza, what we're seeing in the news and so forth. When you threaten people, that here's a list of that your employer, nobody should hire you. And even worse, the government, if you have a green card, if you're not, if you're on a student visa, we should send you away. That is really frightening. One of the things that really troubles me too is I've mentored a lot of students who are refugees, foreign students who come to the United States because we have a great educational system and partly because we value free speech and academic freedom. Are those folks going to come here and give us their talents and work with us anymore when they see that they're not able to engage in political discussions? I think that's a real challenge.
And Jay, I wanted to ask you, how do you think, how is the administration using these types of lists? Should they be using these types of lists?
So I don't believe, I mean, I think there's no evidence that they're using these lists. We don't know, for example, that the student at Tufts was identified by the administration because of her profile on Canary Mission. And we have no idea whether that op-ed that she wrote was the sole or primary basis for her being slated for deportation. So we shouldn't jump to conclusions here about what the students who've been identified for deportation have or have not done. It's also worth keeping in mind that there is precedent for this. In fact, a very important precedent, which is that the Carter administration, both before and after the U.S. embassy was taken over in Iran, slated thousands of Iranian students in the U.S. for deportation for foreign policy reasons and had broad bipartisan support for doing so. And so there are foreign policy reasons to be worried that there are orchestrated campaigns by foreign actors, Qatar in particular, to create harassment and disruption in American institutions, including our universities. And so that might be a legitimate foreign policy concern for the administration to take steps to address, just as the administration of by Jimmy Carter was concerned about the agitation of foreign students with respect to the hostage taking in the U.S. embassy in Tehran.
Let me read this comment from Joey on YouTube, who says Jay is conflating anti-genocide protesting (parentheses good thing) with harassment (parentheses bad thing) in a disingenuous way. So I think it would be incumbent upon you, Jay, maybe to help our listeners understand what you consider to be the harassing behavior on campuses that is, you know, severe enough to incur this response from the administration, and what specifically the universities should have done or should be doing about it, right? Because there's two things here. There is the behavior, but the money is being withheld because of a perceived inaction by the university. So what is the behavior specifically, and what is the action specifically that sure. should have been taken?
So I actually don't think that, this is not a free speech issue. This
Understood.
Is a harassment issue. And so blocking students from crossing campus, which has been filmed repeatedly, there were students at Cooper Union who had to hold up in the library because students were banging on the glass to get them, and they were had to lock themselves inside. Targeting students by writing things on their doors, disrupting class by getting up and chanting things in the middle of classes, occupying university buildings so that they can't engage in their normal operations, as happened at Columbia, Harvard. At Harvard, the administration brought burritos to the students occupying the building, in violation of their rules, right? So they're not enforcing their rules.
So, but
they're
rewarding the enforcement
with burritos.
Right, the enforcement started, and we can get into the specifics of burritos, right? But, you know, sometimes that is just a way to foster some discussion. But putting that aside...
If it were the anti-Pan-African movement,
sure,
chanting for the death of Africans, we wouldn't think it's so sweet that they are occupying the administration building.
I still think it gets
to this
question.
And deliver burritos to them. Because it's Jews, we seem to feel differently about this.
But let me just add, I just want to move it forward here. What is the action, right? So you say, let's take the situation that's accessible to everyone. There is, you said occupying a building or disrupting a class. Is the idea that every single student who was involved in that should have been suspended or expelled?
Universities have procedures for punishment in place for these violations, and they should follow those procedures uniformly and discipline all the students according to their already established procedures.
But I think
and
what
they
we
failed, they failed to do that repeatedly.
Do you agree with that, Ken Stern, that they sort of failed to follow their own rules on this?
No, I think there's some places where you could say that they were slow and so forth, but there are a lot of time, place, and manner restrictions were tightened and clarity, over the last number of months. So I think that they've done task force. And one of the interesting things, if you read the task force, for example, from Stanford on anti-Semitism, they had one on Islamophobia, and you read them in tandem. And that's a useful exercise, because what you realize is that the students who are either pro-Israel Jewish students or Muslim students believe that the administration is unfair, favors the other side, and they can cite evidence. And the Jewish students may say, wait a minute, you know, we follow the rules when we come to do a protest or an event. How come they get away with doing other things that violate the rules? And the pro-Palestinian folks will say, well, how come you didn't really, you know, crack down on people during Occupy Wall Street when there were encampments, and now about this speech you do? So each side can point to a double standard. And what it says to me is that look, nobody should disrupt. It's an academic freedom issue. Nobody should be assaulted and so forth. But there are ways to engage it. Michael Roth at Wesleyan said, when they set up an encampment, you want a camp. You don't harass. We're going to go bring, you know, people in to talk with you. We're going to engage this as an educational enterprise.
But what is harassment? I feel like you've said that's the line, right, Ken? So what is it? What is an action that is so severe that a university should feel compelled to act? And if they don't act, they have violated Title VI. Yeah.
When somebody is actually going and threatening somebody, harassing them, you're yelling at them directly, as opposed to just stating in the principle. My congressional testimony, I went back to remember David Duke, the Klan leader, he was a student at LSU, what did he do? He went on a radio show and said, all blacks should be sent back to Africa. All Jews should be exterminated. And the next year he walked around in a Nazi uniform. He was not disciplined, nor should he have been. He was vilified. If he had been disciplined, he would have turned it into a free speech issue and gotten people on his side on the free speech issue. So the point is to make the distinction between the actual direct physical harassment, intimidation, bullying, and so forth, and speech you don't like, and you push back about the speech.
Let me talk about the pushback on the speech and Canary Mission, just to because I just wanted a chance to chime in on that.
Sure.
So speech has consequences, and actions have consequences. So if David Duke, when he was a student, dressed up in a SS uniform and marched around campus, and this is a public action, public communication, and it's recorded, and then people distribute it online and say, look, this is someone you probably don't want to hire, that would be the natural consequence of his speech and action. And it is not harassing, it is not illegitimate, it is simply publicizing what someone has done in their public actions and speech. And I think Canary Mission is perfectly within its rights. It isn't pleasant. It isn't nice, but they're certainly within their rights publicize public information and make potential future employers aware of the actions and speech of current students.
So you're saying Canary, the folks behind Canary Mission have a free speech right to publicize this, put people's names. I want to ask you, what is something that could happen on campus in protest to what's happening that would be okay? And I want you to take me right to the line of where it would go to a place where you could use Title VI to sort of come at a school versus an action that would be okay. Where is that line? That's what we're trying to get at.
Students are completely free to gather and speak out critically of Israel's actions.
So they can yell, they can scream, they can do whatever they want.
They can do that so long as if they don't disrupt classes that are going on nearby. So they have to do it. There are time, place, and manner restrictions.
Yeah.
So they have to do it in a time and a place where it would not otherwise interfere with the educational activities at the university. They can't block people from crossing the campus. But they are free to organize and speak. And they're free to be as critical of Israel as they want to be critical of Israel. But none of that is in violation of Title VI.
Let me just
and none of that is what the universities have been guilty of allowing. What they've been guilty of allowing is repeated interference with the ability of Jewish students to receive their educational opportunity. And that is in violation of civil rights law and ultimately would make the universities ineligible for federal funding.
And I think we probably don't have time to bring in another comment now. So let me just kick it over to you, Ken, for some closing thoughts as we round out the hour here.
Yeah, I think the major thing is to focus on the fact that there's, again, nobody should be harassed or bullied and so forth. But what we're seeing is an attack on the heart of the educational system. That when, and it's not just about this, we're seeing about DEI, other things. I may not agree with some of what's being taught in those things, but when they're basically saying we're going to insist that you change your hiring policy, that we're going to put things in receivership, that we're going to claw back your funds without any sort of due process. That's a huge damage to the educational institution, which has been a great place and an important place for the Jewish community. In my congressional testimony, I ended by saying, you know, you don't save a house by burning it down. I've seen the administration trying to burn down the house.
Thank you both for your time today on this important topic. Those were the words of Kenneth Stern, director of the Bard Center for the Study of Hate. He is the author of The Conflict Over the Conflict, the Israel-Palestine Campus Debate. And earlier you heard from Jay Green, senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks to you both this hour.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to all the callers we had. Sorry we didn't get to you. Thank you to everybody who emailed in. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show, and our executive producer, Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will, as always, talk to you tomorrow.